I wrote down all my smart remarks, so I wouldn't forget any of them. Okay. Let's see, what smart remark to begin with? They don't look so smart when you get up here. Look up there. They were smarter at home. One thing for all the graduate students. Hopefully tonight we'll get the answer to the big question, what does Vance Borghele do when he's not correcting all those student essays he assigns?
You don't want to know.
Okay. And those of you that know me know that I'm going to be reading 7 stories tonight. And for those of you that don't know me, don't panic because it's only 8 pages. And this was a conspiracy between Vance and myself that to have a short reading so that we can have a long party afterwards. Unless, of course, Vance decides to play his cornet, and then it may go on forever. So. And one last request for all of you to come to the party so that I can tell my mother that everyone ate the hors d'oeuvres so she'll understand what I'm doing in college. Okay. One of the poets began his reading in the undergraduate poetry by saying, "This reading means a great deal to me," and I started thinking about that, and this reading means a great deal to me because now I don't have to feel guilty for not taking workshop. because I'm here, and some of them aren't. I'm going to be reading from a novel in progress, and it's titled Eleanor, and that's the feature character. It's really a collection of short stories, but because we're living in the 90s, I get to call it a novel, and I don't have to write a novel in order to get out of here. I can just write stories, which are a lot more fun. And also, what you need to know about Eleanor probably is that she's a second grade teacher, and amazingly enough, she's a young woman about my age, having a similar life. And there's no physical description of Eleanor in the story, but I decided that she probably looks a lot like this t-shirt, so this is probably Eleanor. The other thing, my friend Dan asked me if Eleanor was autobiographical, and I guess the real answer is no, because Eleanor has a lot better imagination than I do. And as a last remark, because they're getting boring, in pursuit of giving a fictional quality to life, I'd like to dedicate Tony Hoagland's portion of this reading to Lester Fender. Okay. Stories. Hopefully these are from somewhere within a novel. The first one is titled Dating Instructions, and it's a very short story. It goes like this. "The thing you have to do is date," Mark said to Eleanor. "That's what I do. I date. I play softball and date. You either have to play softball or go paddling in a canoe, and you have to date." Okay, and the next story is called A Good Time. And this is one of the longer stories because it's a couple pages. It goes like this. Eleanor went for a good time, though later she was told she made a mistake in thinking they were there for a good time. Still, intermittently, a good time was had. Placing hands in men's hip pockets, stroking the cords of their jeans, mingling tongues, laughing at difficult jokes. It's fun to have a secret that no one knows and to laugh about it when the time comes, someone said. I have a secret, Eleanor said. In about a week, I will be laughing at it. She laughed, but of course she could not tell the secret, so no one else laughed. At the party, it was fun when they each understood what the other was talking about. People at the party enjoyed watching the police helicopter beam its lights on another party. That was the kind of party it was, where people were vicariously at other parties. At least, she thought that was the kind of slice of party that she saw as she watched other slices and mounds of the party on their separate plates, scattered on the dirt yard. Eleanor assumed certain things by the way the pieces of the party lay quietly on their plates with only small, circular movements. She assumed boredom. She equated activity with not boredom. At a party, music could stand for activity, but there was no music. She shredded plastic cups and drew men in under her shoulder as an activity. Her blue stretch top and right hip became a point of interest at the party, at least for some. She realized that for others, the party was quite a different thing, though what it was for them, she knew she could not know. She realized that someone at the party was forming his slice of the party by making a story about her, a story with many male characters and long hands. She tried to step into his creation of his story of the party as he watched her create a shape in her own party image with her slice. His story would be twisted, she could see, probably cliched. He would think the slice was the whole story, and the story would have to pass through his pockmarked face and thinning graying hair before it could revolve in his brain, gather pieces to itself along the wall of its own centrifuge, before the story could be peeled off the inside of his mind like so much pressed paper. She didn't want to read that story, see that paper. It was probably dull and cliched. It would be the old story about motivation, so important to the story, could only be fragmented and cliched, could only seem to be insightful and complete. But like streamers of newsprint stuck in her hair, his story followed her outside of the party to the front walk and goodbye. His story opened with the repugnancy of the smell of patchouli, an old cliched smell from the 60s, he said. A bad beginning, she who wore patchouli should have realized right away. But Eleanor was busy leaving, heading towards activity, going dancing, swimming. A blonde boy was waiting. The man making the story was willing to give her a chance, though, he said. What the chance would be for confused her. She left her thoughts unpictured, thinking only in white light. She allowed her thoughts to disperse, to squirm off in threads of color. He asked her about the men, the pockets, the tongue, and how she perceived them. She did not perceive them, she told him. She did not perceive well at parties. He, though, was an amasser of perceptions, a root ball of perceptions. He perceived her as frantic, useless, groping, not of his needs, he told her, as she explained about the party, the dancing, the boy waiting, the quest for a good time. Okay. The next one is called The Stone Father. And it begins with a song from Children's Camp, which I won't sing to you because I can't sing, but I'll read it to you. And as a footnote to that, the title is I'm a Ranger Bob. And Ranger Bob is a real forest ranger from California, at least as real as any forest ranger from California could be. And this song is about what he would really say. And it goes like this. I'm a Ranger Bob, you're a Ranger Bob, we are Ranger Bobs all. And when we get together, we give a Ranger Bob call. The trees are your friends. Okay, so, Stone Father. The Stone Father salutes goodbye from the distance of his high carpeted platform. From her pathway, she returns his salute. Goodbye, Stone Father. How does it feel to be the child of this hard, sand-surfaced father? The feeling is pinned to the back of her like a large waving kite on a short string and follows her wherever she goes, as again tonight she leaves the Stone Father's house for her own. She moves about her room, unpacking. Stone Father, I'm home, Eleanor says out loud. The walls of her house are empty and white. There is nothing to fill them. They slam into each other. Their many corners enclose their loud noise in a space that is empty and white. She stands near a piling of corners, lost. She can't have the stone father, she knows now. She has the corners and the walls. She is nowhere now, in dead space. The stone father has left only his indifferent salute to her. She begins to giggle. She hides it with her hand. Standing in the corner, facing it, she sings, I'm a Ranger Bob, and hopes the stone father is not listening. This song is not for the children of the stone father. Their songs have been taken away. The songs are in the trees now, away from the stone father and his children that remain. I'm a Ranger Bob is a song about another father, a different father, one with trees. The stone father never listens to the trees, so the verses are safe. Eleanor slides back across time to the stone father's house again, where he never listens at all, it seems, until she is on the phone, accidentally humming, You're a Ranger Bob, and then he comes on the other line. She puts down the receiver, ashamed. This father built her first house, a stone house, and kept out the dead, the night, with his knowledge of smooth, hard stones. When she goes, she wants to take away these stones, this knowledge, and not just songs of trees. She wants her smooth, white corners to be built of stones. She wants to hum this on the line for him, but there are no songs for stones. Where have you gone, stone father? She asks the white wood corner of her new house. She invents gladness over soft things and tucks herself into bed, singing. Now she hopes not to find the stone father, but of course he is there. She has his image in the palm of her right hand. She crushes it. She lies in bed, spread eagle, crushing her right hand. In the morning, she turns the pages of the newspaper with her crushed hand and reads about the death of the stone father. But she cannot find peace. That only the stone father can give, and he is dead stone. If his death would make any difference, she would be glad, but it won't. Maybe when her hand heals, it will make a difference, but it is too early to tell. The past, though, goes on, and in it, the stone father laughs. He is outside his house talking to the neighbor, and he laughs. Eleanor steps outside to be near him. Ha, ha, he says, looking briefly at her. But she is not the joke. She is only the child of the stone father. She goes back inside, but does not laugh. It has been so long since the stone father has made her laugh that neither of them plan for it anymore.
Break time. Okay, and the next one's called Biting the Glass, and this one's for Terry. And it begins with the epigraph from a Dick Shelton poem that goes like this. It has never been easy fighting the desire to eat glass. Okay? When something is too hard for me to do, I set it up so that I do more and more of it. That way it seems less hard at first. And I know there is so much more to go, so at least at first it seems less hard. Last week, there were some hard times, so this week I'm going over and over them again. Now, last week seems much easier, though this week has been very hard, Eleanor explains and crosses her legs in the seat of her chair. It began with a boy, 26, dark, hairy, culturally good-looking, going through the motions of biting a glass. Can you see his twisted grin as he crunches it? Eleanor asked. Most people look through the glass, he told me, putting it to his eye. I want someday someone to bite the glass. Rawr, he said as he pretended to crush it beneath his teeth. At first, he said, I'd like to talk to you for about 100 hours. And then we'd be finished with each other and gone to other things, I said. So after talking about 100 hours, but mostly in silences, we've moved on to other things. Eleanor lifts her brown hair from her neck with both arms, lifting against space, which is collapsing on her from the walls. But love, Eleanor thought, dragging broken baggage, trash, rags, the chair into the waiting room. But love, she thought, as these were heaped upon her, handed to her, exchanged, replaced. But love, she said, to each note not left upon the door. Watching movies, why do we believe that certain foreigners are more honest than we? The woman asked herself. I've never talked to anyone like this before, the Soviet comrade said, the college football player said, the boy with dark hair said. But Eleanor believes them all. She believes that it is all true, that it has never been said before, that everything is new and unique and temporary and gone. All the boys have honest eyes, Eleanor says, looking at her wallet photo collection. I tell them all that they have wonderful green eyes. That is what they say about mine. They all tell stories so well. They all hold up the glass. They all leave notes. There is a stack of notes always outside on the chair. When I leave, even for a moment, I know I will return to a note that one of them has left. The notes are written on the backs of old poems, flyers, postcards, whatever they can find left over from the mail. You said you were shy, uncomfortable in the light. You turned on it. You sat cross-legged on the bed, naked. You pulled the curtains open and waited until morning when it was light again, and you stood naked at the window, the woman says to Eleanor. I smell like heaven, Eleanor says. It is because I smell like someone else. It is the heaven of having someone else break through into this world of blank papers and neat tabletops. I turn on the radio for voice and put on this shirt that he has touched for smell and have only thought left to myself and the papers and the tabletops. Eleanor is silent then and shows she is finished. Do not be impressed, Eleanor later writes in her journal. We are dying in unimportant ways here. A case of light brown hair in payment for kicking, stabbing, for specifics like the smell of clothes, curly dark arm hair, glass. It's 2 short ones left. Or 3 short ones. This one's called A Story with Horses in It. One day while Eleanor was swimming laps, Eleanor remembered that she knew how to swing onto a horse. She started thinking of the house in the country she was going to visit and that maybe there would be chickens and cows and horses there. And she saw herself grabbing the horse's mane with her right hand, her strong side, and being able to swing her left leg over and up onto the horse. She wondered why she pictured herself doing that, and then she remembered that she used to know how to do it and did it all the time. She remembered that she could ride backwards and ride hanging off the side, and that she could reach down the rein off the ground even if the horse was galloping. And she remembered that she could ride with no bridle at all, just swing on and go. And she wondered what the people at the party would think if they saw her just swing on and go. And then she remembered that there probably wouldn't be any horses at the party, and that her own horse, the Palomino that she was swinging onto, was dead. Okay, last Eleanor story is called The Happy Student. On one day, Eleanor saw her happy student. She had known him for a year, and no matter what he was doing, he was happy. "Why are you always so happy?" Eleanor finally asked him. "There's so much for me to do here," he said, looking up and smiling, lifting a yellow shovel out of the sand. On Thursday, Eleanor told her friend at the teacher's lunch table at school, "I was worried about what we would do for free period today. We only have one free period a week, so it's special for all of us. But then I figured out what we could do, and now I'm happy. It seems these days that if one little thing goes right, it's enough to make me happy for a long while." Okay. And the last piece is not an Eleanor piece, and it's dedicated to my fellow MFAs, the MUFFA people, and my teacher and our next reader, Vance. And it's titled, The Critical Session. It's another short one. The Critical Session. You bring in the stories of your life, neatly typed on white paper, and stack them on the floor for him to read. You lay down on your side, and you look at them in profile, noticing that they are 7/8 of an inch high, and that the edges feather into dark and white spaces. He stands and looks at them from above. When he discusses them, you have no idea what he is talking about.
I'm not going to sing Ranger Bob either. I might play the cornet, but not immediately. And I might not. It's a kind of threat. It's here if you get inattentive. That's kind of a prop that I need for what I'm going to read, which is a piece of a novel I'm working on. It almost isn't even the first draft. It's some trial stuff. I suspect that a good deal of what you hear tonight will never be printed. It's told in the voice of a young man named Mike Mazurin, who will start explaining himself right away. Mike allows himself to do some very playful things with language, things that I wouldn't permit myself to do, which is probably why I'm writing it in his person rather than my own. The title of the book is The Great Fake Book. That will be explained in context. And one of the things that I will probably discard is the following passage, which is actually a conversation I had with my son last summer. He's 22 years old and a great rock expert. And he wanted to know what I was writing about. He said, "What's it about, Dad?" "I don't know," I said helpfully. "You never want to tell me what it's about. Youth and music, I guess. Wouldn't that make it more my kind of thing to write than yours?" "Sure it would. Unless you mean..." "Yes," I said. "Youth ago and long time music." And so I say that may or may not actually precede the book. There are some, there's some other matter that goes before this, but we now start with the date December 29th, 1945. And every once in a while I'll throw in a song title, and eventually you may understand why. After December 29th, 1945, it says, "Begin the Beguine." Today, on my bittersweet way out of the Army Discharge Center in Faraday, North Carolina, I stole that goofy-looking horn. There it lies, coyly, shining up at me from the other double bed in room 300B, the Grand Commerce Hotel. I don't know what it is. I do not know. A group of nine of us new-hatched, sweet, veteran bitterbirds were scratching and pecking out of step toward the gate of Faraday, carrying duffel bags and green musettes. We passed a fine, pink-panted first lieutenant bird, peered at him, twittering, and jointly failed to raise our wings, save for a curly-crested tall Tech 3 named Lon, who hollered, "Tanch hup," dropped his gear, and leapt into a salute that went over the line into catatonic. We applauded, hoping it was irony. The lieutenant hurried on. Then we started past a double-deckered wooden barracks building with an open door at Dirt Street level. Me, Mike, I always look in open doors. And inside this one is a room where I could see a tuba lying on its side, looking quite drunk. And there were music stands, and then a row of snare drums on the seats of chairs, flutes, clarinets, garrison caps and full dress jackets, the jackets hanging over the chair backs. I slowed down, fell back from the group that I was pecking with, stuck my head in the door, and there was no one in the room. There were a lot more instruments, saxophones, glockenspiels. You can probably bet your ass that there were glockenspiels, if that's the kind of bet you like to make. I set my duffel down and slid in fast, wanting to clip a trumpet. When I got in, I could hear talking and farting in the other room, so I grabbed the first hand-sized brass instrument with valves I saw and got back out again. It did seem to me that this thing I had stuffed down the front of my Eisenweasel jacket against my chest might just be comical and oversized, but I didn't quite dare take a look. There was a trash can just outside the door, its cover off, and a big brown empty paper sack crumpled on top of it. I lifted the sap sucker, hunched over it, and looked away, whistling to prove I wasn't up to anything unusual, and bagged my fat horn, picked up the double and swung it, showing the folks my young exuberance, and double-peckered up to catch my group. In charge, but not much, was a buck sergeant. His name is Fetlock, an agreeable, plump buck sergeant, and the best of Fetlock luck, and pots of beer. He'd been dreaming aloud of beer all morning as we processed through. "Mike, my boy, what's in the paper bag?" he asked when I caught up. "Budweiser," I said. "You want a can?" "Don't you wish," said Sergeant Fetlock. What I wished when I looked at the good, pink, sweating sergeant who'd had mortar teams at Leyte and at Guam and been twice wounded was that my eye didn't keep rending him into bloody chicken parts. These nine freed bipeds were, like many others, being let out early because we'd met the weasel. I kept chickens as a kid from year to year, had them killed some years, but never dreamed I'd be one. Now comes the weasel, chewing into the coop, and then his mad little twitchy nose pokes in, and his squirrely cartoon eyes, and he snickers and gets his tiny hard-on for the killing, the same teensy hard-on that the admirals and generals get, probably the presidents and kings as well, worshiping the weasel god. Then the cute rascal kills, or nutsy and indifferent about it, half-kills every fucking chicken he can catch, and may or may not trouble to eat one, before he realizes the yardarm's up there buggering the sun again. Time to slurry over to the Weasel Club to slosh some bourbon or some vodka, some sake, cognac, schnapps, or say, an ounce or two of pissy half-warm scotch. And what's left behind in the caves and on the beaches is piles of half-animate blood and shit and feathers. That will do for the bitter. I suppose the sweet is remembering the extra shot of morph your friend the medic gave you when he found you hurting in the pile, little Balfour, popping himself a shot for company and to keep from crying. That and the long dream of something called love that people seem to think was out here for us past the gates of Faraday. Lovely to look at. We got to the entrance of the army camp and could see the town out behind it. I moved into the middle of our sloppy little tachmo where the sentries paid no attention to my ridgeback paper sack. The sentries were two privates with no ribbons on their bright dress khakis, so they hadn't been cooped up for very long. "You never had it so good," my buddies serenaded them, "and oh, my ass doth bleed for you." Me, Mike, I kept quiet. In the still of the night, even with the weasel caught in cage, their downy balls would drear regret it, but I didn't say so. I'm 23. I've been Sam's flightless cage bird for 4 years. I had no burning in my dodo heart to hassle the draftees. The sentries, they could have asked to see our papers, check our gear, they didn't. My sack and I were free and clear. We nine came to a stop beyond the gate and, unskilled at freedom, took our first shy look around. Every store facing the army camp gate was an improvised civilian clothing store. The merchant in their doorways, beckoning like whores in Sailor Town. No one in our group had known any of the other eight before we processed out today. But now we turned toward one another and moved close. "Anyone want to find a tavern?" Sergeant Fetlock asked. A couple of the guys said, "Sure." The curly-haired salutatorian said, "Hey, no kidding, man. We'd ought to come with him to the Baptist church and there give thanks for safe deliverance." Fetlock, milder than I could have been, said, "Well, he thought he'd just give thanks his own way, Lonnie." A slim black corporal of engineers with fingers missing said, "Bye-bye, new clothes for him, but not the junk they sell here by the gate." Buck Sergeant Fetlock looked at me. "Tavern, Mike?" I smiled, wanting nothing more than to see what I might have hidden in my paper bag, and said, "No, thank you, Sergeant." "Did you get the mouthpiece?" Fetlock asked. "Good question, good, my sergeant." I don't have much blush left in me. I did a graceless Susie Q to say farewell and took on Allie, warm under arm. The sack was getting pretty nubbly. I held it tight, duffel in the other hand, musette bag riding on my shoulders like a canvas kid. In my 4 years, this was the only chance I'd got for any decent looting. The rapine and pillage openings out there hadn't been so hot either. So I stopped in the alley, sat on the duffel, away from cries and eyes, and withdrew the instrument to have a happy little float. It sorely puzzled me. Still does, there on its own sweet bed. It's too long and too plumpet to be a nice trumpet. Tubes are too straight. And it's got a really big and silly looking mouth. I looked down its bell, there in the alley, and pushed its valves in and out. It sort of simpered back. I tried grimacing at it, sneering, shook my head and frowned. Finally, I felt myself smile and I said to the horn, "You goof," and put it back in the sack, whereat it tucked itself under my arm like an ugly, confident pet. And Sergeant Fetlock was quite right, by the way, I haven't got the mouthpiece. Maybe if they'd had a band waiting for me and Fetlock and Lonnie the Baptist and the disfigured, slim black corporal of engineers, waiting at the end of the 4-year, 20,000-mile round bumpy trip, waiting when we finally slouched off the unheated bus from Nashville, after the overheated train from Seattle, after the wallowing slow troop trip from Japan, maybe if, smiling, standing straight, the army band from Faraday had just been waiting there to start in playing Welcome Home, guys, as we stood dead-souled, dry-eyed, to ourselves ever having said, "This is our own, our native land, for Christ's sake." Maybe then I would have left the man his horn. Now, as it is, I quite enjoy the image of him with that mouthpiece, nothing left to use it in, coming back from break to start back up rehearsing for some sweetheart little officer ruction. Bet they're right now pulling on their nice pink pants to have a nice stance. "Hey, baby ration." I don't think I actually called this out loud to the imaginary horn blower from my duffel in the alley, but maybe I did. "Hey now, I got you a good idea for the officer's entertainment. Okay? How about you drop your khakis, bend over, ram that homeless mouthpiece halfway up and squeeze? And have your friend the tuba player blow some real high notes through while you open up your mouth to let them out like bursts of joyous song." Oh, clean and smooth, this Michael mind of mine. Exactly like a fine steel trap that's been left underwater for 4 years, sprung, rusted out, and sealed it over. Mornhorn, I said there in the alley. I guess that part must have been outlawed. Let's find us a hotel and spend some of this mustardy ouch pay. And I stroll along singing the well-known joyous song, mustardy ouch, custardy couch, piss and douche and over the river. Maybe it was the weasel sprung my trap and left it, but I'd got a little snip of toenail off him here under my arm. So that made the horn more than a pet. It was my dad, my affianced, my too long, too fat, straight-tubed, comical, and only girl. I smoothed her brown paper party hat in case the millinery police were out and looking. Now, I'll skip a little scene and pick up Mike again the next day with his horn at Merrill's Music Mart in Faraday. He has left North Carolina. And the song title here is "The Best Things in Life." The best things in life are free. Standing behind the counter at Merrill's Music Mart when I walked in today with my no-name horn back in its sack again, was an amazing young clerk, the only male human I've ever seen who could be called China Doll Pretty, antique China Doll. His hair is ash blonde, and he wears it in the first duck-ass haircut I've seen outside of pictures in the Japanese edition of the Stars and Stripes. He has huge, dark lavender eyes, brows considerably darker than his hair, and amongst the coral pigment is so bright and the cleft in the upper lip so distinctly outlined that I thought for a moment he might be using makeup. His skin is creamy and almost transparent. You feel as if any moment you might start seeing x-ray shadows of his cheekbones through it. He's not a very big kid. He's probably 17. It was suddenly so spooky thinking he might be drafted soon that I came close to bursting out, blurting out, "God damn, don't ever let them draft you." But I didn't say that. Instead, I took little Bighorn out of the bag, put her on the counter, keeping a hand behind the belt, and said, just like it happened all the time, "Say, I lost my mouthpiece." "Well, I don't wonder," said the clerk. "You always keep your horn in a paper sack?" "Sure," I said, in a kind of doesn't everybody tone. "You'd ought to keep it in a case." "You got a case?" He shook his head. "I'm not even sure we got a mouthpiece for that," he said. "What is it anyhow?" "Isn't exactly delicate looking, just a touch unearthly." Wouldn't they find earth enough for this one in the chicken yard? It was a hateful vision, that boy in green fatigues, with non-coms leering at him, and it still stuck right in the middle of my head, between and behind the eyes. I said, "Mind seeing if you've got one? Case? Mouthpiece?" "Mouthpiece for what? I mean, well, what in the world is that?" I leaned back casually and muttered a word of which he was met only to hear the last syllable. Duck-ass horn? "Why, sure," he said. "I just never did see one before." He smiled and fetched. "Well, I know we got cornet, trumpet, and euphonium. Got sousaphone. Well, see, for the high school band here, we got quite a band." His effusive voice was pretty phony. So was mine. "I can imagine. Are you in it?" No, he wasn't. And I didn't raise my lavender-eyed boy to be a soldier either. I watched him mess around with his hand in a deep drawer that opened out of the counter. I leaned over so that I could see into it. It looked like the place where mouthpieces go to die. There were some new ones in boxes. Mostly it was old tarnished pieces and nicked and scarred, silver and chrome and nickel and bronze, washes and plating run away to put base metal, I do not know. "Trade-ins," my sideburned blonde boy said. "Well, now, can I find one? I can get you a dollar off if you got a trade-in." "Well, now, I swear to God, I just don't got one." It made him laugh. He started trying various of the secondhand mouthpieces one by one to see if they'd go into the tube at the playing end of my horn. The cornet ones were tapered wrong, and the trumpet ones would just go in a little way. "Just put it in a little way," said a smirky voice behind me, and I looked back to see a big, pale, flaccid, jowly man around 40 in a green check jacket who'd come out of the back room of the store and paused. He was wearing black-rimmed glasses. "E.B. Binky Jones," he said, addressing the clerk and raising his voice to falsetto on Binky. "Can I just put it in a little way? It won't hurt, I promise." Then the green-checked, flaccid man went into an office off the sales floor laughing and closed the door. My side boy squeezed his mouth up tight and was trembling in a way that made the flesh of his cheek. The big, dark, deep-set lavender eyes teared up. I said, "E.B., the boss, huh? Shit, man, it doesn't matter." E.B. Jones turned loose his tightly held together mouth just long enough to say, "I'll kill him." Then he pulled the big showcase drawer all the way out, heaved it onto the counter in front of me, and ran. He went, obviously, to the washroom, in which dank sanctum I could tell from the briny smell of food and stomach acids when he got back, he'd had to throw up. It's a sweet, true world I'm learning to drive myself around in, after the sweetness and truth into which I got myself towed away 4 years ago. By the time E.B. Jones emerged, purged of the urge to re-urge, I'd sorted through some few of those mouthpieces and found one that, by God, merged. Stamped into the metal is the formula Bach 10.5 CFL, which didn't mean a thing to me. But it slipped into my looted beauty like the ass piece of a jigsaw puzzle. When I saw E.B. crack brighter and tighter lipped than ever, it occurred to me to take this fitting mouthpiece out again and lay it aside mixed in with some others. You find anything, he asked. Not yet. I sure am sorry. It's okay, E.B., forget it. He makes me throw up pretty near every day, the young clerk said. The accent had lost class. It was Hill Pure Billy now, and I liked it a lot. Maybe one in that pile will fit, I said. Pretty near every day, talking or grabbing at me. Odd, it hadn't occurred to me to suppose he'd be effeminate before he said that, just young and southern. Now I'd begun to wonder. Meanwhile, he was picking up mouthpieces from the pile I'd made, trying them, sorting through. Sometimes what he likes to do is knock just with his knuckles like on the washroom door when I'm pissing, and he'll knock and stand out there breathing, and I just can't help but puke, and then he laughs. Hey, look at this. Suddenly he was grinning. Hey, soldier, look. He had it. Bach 10.5 CFL, snug into the horn. I grinned back and said, swell, goodney, how much? E.B. looked over at the office door, gave it a vicious corkscrew finger, and handed me the mouthpiece. I shrugged, smiled, and put it in my pocket, barely in time. It was still in motion when the office door opened. I looked over, and there was the man in black glasses and the green check jacket looking back at me. Why do I know every detail of his clothing? I can't say. The pants were brown and baggy, the shoes brown and dull shine, and he wore a white sports shirt with a Peter Pan collar outside the lapel of the jacket. His face looked ripply now, as if I could see black, close-shaved beard undulating, trying to grow up through the pallor of his flesh. He held my eyes for a good long beat before he said, well, getting what you crave, soldier? You haven't got it. He came over to look. Hey, Bo, flugelhorn. You need a mouthpiece, do you? He reached. Flugelhorn? I didn't like it to be him who told me what it was I'd stolen. I said, no, nothing, the horn away. I didn't want him to touch it either. He didn't. Instead, he changed directions of grab and touched the young clerk's hand. E.B. snatched it off, blowtorched. Greenbeard chuckled and said in his soft, suggestive voice, where'd you get that flugel, soldier? Pawn shop, I said, and I'm not a soldier. What pawn shop was that? The one your mother runs to Friday nights, I said, to sell her ass for Muscatel. It was my fear reaction. It's about all you learn in the Army. When you're scared, hit. He was reaching again for the instrument, and I said, leave it the hell alone. His voice got really soft, which was really scary. I can get you a mouthpiece, he said. And it sounded about the same to me as if he said, I can call us a policeman. High school band man now. He's got some extra. Got them from me. No, he does. So you come back now in the morning, hear? Yes, I heard. We heard. Me and my fluted flugelhorn. There were no sirens in the street, but we wanted to run. We still do, and can't. And even got a mouthpiece, too. I've huffed it hard. Can't get a piff of the sound out of it. I will. Oh, little horn of Faraday, I want to leave here now. Want to go look for New Year's Eve tomorrow, any place but Carolina. So why not? Because when Greenbeard flaxied back into his awful orifice, a pale, coral-lipped kid with lavender eyes who'd given me a fresh stole mouthpiece for my fresh stole flugelhorn grabbed onto my wrist. E.B. Binky Jones grabbed it tight and asked me urgently, what's your name? It was a goddamn plea. Mike, I said, Mike Mazurum, and couldn't get my wrist back out of the vice unless I'd want to fight him for it. You've got to come back tomorrow, Mike, he said. That's what he wants. Why? He's got some reason. Listen, if you don't, he'll know I'd give you that mouthpiece for your duck ass horn. Let me pay for it, I said to E.B. Tell him you found it after he went back into his office. E.B. Jones just clung. Anyway, it's a flugelhorn, I said. He clung tighter. All right, I said, and got my wrist back. I'll be here. Make-believe ballroom. This morning, in my letterbox at the hotel, was a note on the back of a blank sales slip from Merrill's Music Farm. Can't get your mouthpiece till after dinner. Come about 4:30 p.m. Seems strange. I'd understood they were going to close the store at noon for the holiday. But when I went in an hour ago, E.B. Jones was right where he'd been behind the counter when I left the day before. He tried for a smile, but I could hear him sigh as I went by, horn and sack, first mouthpiece left behind, into the office where the green-cheeked man was sitting. Only today his green jacket was a different shade. I'm sorry, the green-checked man, listen. Only today his green jacket was a different shade, Kelly green maybe, with darker green and flecks, not checks. His shirt was unbelievable, orange with bone buttons. The cheeks were still loose and flaccid, the shaved area still dark and shifty, the glasses rims black and somehow wet-looking like reboiled coffee. Hey, come on in, he said. You brung it. His office is small, with a little window about head level that opens into the same alley I traveled yesterday. There's a desk of golden oak, a chair behind and one in front. It's a pretty well-filled room. Give it here a minute. I stood there looking at him and shook my head, no. He reached into one of the desk drawers and took out a small box. Looky here. He opened the box and took out a silvery mouthpiece like the one I'd left behind, but much shinier. He pointed it at me, leaned forward, and his voice went very, very soft. Now, if you've got one of these already, it's going to be one you and little Pinky found yesterday, right? All right. I think there was one, but it's not there now. You got your sales slip, Paul? Slurping off. Got your sales slip from that pawn shop you were telling about? There's only one in town. He don't think he sold no fluval. Not yesterday. Not ever. Then there was a nutty sort of shift into pathos. Hey, Paul, I've been buying me flugelhorn this war. Things got so hard. Metal things. Hard to get. See? Look, now I got this one part. You got that other. My part's not for sale, I said. What do you want for yours? I figured it was going to be a stick-up. He could point that thing at me and make me pay whatever price he wanted. Got a different notion, Bolt. Would you trade? Would you trade it, though? Would you listen? Would you want? Bastard was practically singing. As he reached behind himself, down to a shelf, swung a case onto the desktop and opened it. Lovely and shining, nestling in blue-green felt, was a perfect little horn. The petite and darling kid and shimmering sister of my fat and tarnished flame. This is sure a nice cornet by Holmes, the finest line he is, the best they make. Look here, she got the trigger, got the slide, got the quick round change to A. Would you try it? Would you want it? Oh, yes, I want it. It's bell caps and mother of pearl. More than a trumpet, more than anything else I've ever seen. No thanks, I said. But Greenbird smiles. He put the cornet to his lips. He looked away toward his little window. He played a short, meditative phrase of blues, paused, and added another twice as long, slow and soft with quick hard edges. Then he repeated the pair with the hard and soft reverse, added a new phrase, medium speed and pretty. He resolved the whole thing in an unexpected burst of double time, but then the bastard retarded his resolution for a final repetition. And God, it was coming out so sad and gold, like a gauzy girl in sun glow putting flowers on a soldier's grave. And I never, never wanted him to stop. Yes, yes, I yearned for an instrument with sounds like those in it. Green Flecker smiled as flashed its smile and slightly did extend the gleaming cornet toward me. I sat down then, but I hugged Big Silly tighter. Green took off his blacks and showed dark, hurt, naked eyes. I think he felt he almost had me. Hey, he crooned. Hey, Bo, you know anything at all about that psychology? It could have been the start of the vocal to what he'd been playing. Huh? Psychology, thought maybe you'd been to college, sure. Psychology, thought maybe junior college just before the war, I said. Long time, and let me tell you, wish I had and look. I bet you thought I shouldn't say that thing I said to little Binky yesterday. You thinking that way, Bo? Your business, I said. Jones did mention the possibility of killing you. Green Birdie smiled a smile. Sensitive, ain't he? I kept my smile to myself. Now that's a little old country boy, E. Binky Jones, from way back up the hill. Picks guitar country good and sing those country high sweet songs. Got him a girl now. That surprise you? Why should it, I asked. Well, it seems like sometimes he's about half girl set. You didn't notice? I stood up again. Now, wait right there, Horn. You studying up that junior psychology there in college, you might set me straight. Maybe you'll say I'm doing wrong, but listen first. When E.B. was a little fella, his big brother Marvin, see, these boys my nephews, he stood the little cornet on its bell, turned it slowly so it threw light, caressing its pearly bounds. Sister's boys, anyhow. Big Marvin's kind of bad. Now, see, he'd come home drunk. They was poor, lived in a little hutch back in the hills. So then the boys slept in the same bed, and Marvin get in there, well, drunk, like I said, with E.B. and turn him over. What? Turn him over. Put it to him. And here's just what I think. Now, maybe you can help me. E.B., he's just that shy. I have to push and push to get him to play and sing in public. But he does. Place called Rombo's. He's getting straight. Going to be all right. I'm his uncle. That's what I'm hoping now. You think E.B. ought to pretend that with Marvin never happened? Ain't it psychology that E.B.'s got to say, hell yes, that happened to me. Now forget it. Cuss old drunk Marvin that's in jail now. And anyway, and E.B., just go on about his guitar checking business. Now that's why I bring it up. See, ain't I right? No, I said, you're wrong. Okay. The way you do it makes him sick. I think you ought to let the kid alone. Is that right? It's damn right, I said. He stroked his chin. He halfway nodded. Then he smiled, a new beard-shadowed, pale green smile, hangdog and winning, laid the cornet in its case where it kept gleaming at me, and said, need a fake book, don't you? Say, tell me your name now. Willie, please sit down. Willie, please, I said. Come on now. Mike, I told him, he said. He nodded. He got up and went to the office door, opened it as if to make sure no one was listening, closed it, locked it. Fake book, he whispered. Got one to go with you, Horn? I didn't have the slightest notion what he was talking about, and I'm sure it showed. Everything I feel shows on my idiot face. But the green slick man managed to ignore it. Bet you don't. Bet you've been in the army all this time and lost it, kind of forgot it. You sure remember how goddamn illegal it is, won't you? While he crooned, he was on the drawer in his desk, getting out a fat book, 8.5 by 11, with a brown, light cardboard cover and a spiral binding. He slid it toward me. Touch it, you'd go to jail. I didn't touch it, but I read the title, Volume 1 of Over 1,000 Songs. If you say so, I muttered. I wanted to touch it. Mike, you're not some kind of cop. Limited editions of the cover. Professional use only, priced $50. I touched it. I flipped it, and it opened to page 63. There were the choruses of three songs there, A Little Bit of Heaven, Pretty Baby, Prisoner of Love. The melody for each was written on one staff of treble clef with the lyric below it. Alone from night to night you'll find me, too weak to break the chains that bind me. And above the staff, rendered in abbreviations for chords like A flat, 7th, and F minor, the series of chords for harmonizing, which are called the changes. I might never have heard of the fake book, but I'd heard of the copyright law, and I understood Greenbeard's. Still, it wasn't fear. I turned to page 176 and saw Cherry, Chicago, China Boy. Not fear that made my pores pump cool and the body hairs stand up. It was pure thrill, as if he'd handed me a working book of magic spells. These are the songs, shallow and sentimental, every one, but absolutely profound in the depths to which they can stir memory, revive hope, promise beauty. And they're the songs even more important for a nut like me of jazz, the canon of jazz, like Homer to Greek tragedy, or the nut who wrote the Chronicles as to Shakespeare's history plays. Mike, name a song, the man said. Jada? Turned 190. He said this in a tone so close to reverence that he could have added, let us pray, and maybe I would have landed on my knees. 190, yes, I would do anything for you, jazz me blues, and Jada in the middle. Jada. Oh, didn't that green-flecked shit play Jada on his low-cut old cornet? It has not laid Jada fast, nor did he. It has played as if it were a ballad, in such a way that the nonsense words, Jada, Jada, jing, 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 sounding in one's head, become poignant. If Oh, Didn't He Ramble is taps for the funeral of a black jazz musician, maybe Jada would be taps for the funeral of a white one. But the green and flaccid bastard didn't give me time to think of anything like that. You name a song now, he said urgently. You name one. Ghost of a Chance. You turn to 21, Bo, Mike. You turn there. He was playing that sweet, strange song already before I reached the page, vaporizing it into a cascade of rending sounds like perfect paper, tearing perfectly as he came out of the release. And he had barely finished before the cased cornet was in one of my hands, the fake book in a paper sack in the other, the flugelhorn in Greenbeard's lap, and me, Mike, on my way out of the office, the door to which I heard him close and lock behind me. I stared at E.B. Jones, still standing behind his counter. I was too dazed by the music, who he was at first. E.B. looked a little dazed himself. "He didn't ever," E.B. said. "What?" "That there. It's his cornet you got." I nodded. "God almighty, he'd give you his cornet?" I guess we swapped. "Swapped you? God almighty. God darn, he must have wanted that, some kind of horny horn." I started coming to then and said, "He might quit riding." "Riding? E.B., he's your uncle." "Yes, sir." "He told me about your brother." "My what?" "Your brother Marvin that's in jail." "God almighty. You've got a brother?" "Got one sister's all." "Hey, he's been, you don't come from a little hutch way back up in the hills?" "Lived here in Faraday my whole dang life." "You don't you play guitar and sing?" "He's been telling you his lies." "You don't sing at a place called Rombo's?" "He sure can mix it." "Yes, sir, I play at Rombo's." "No, sir, don't sing at all. Sister sings, we twins. And me, and there's a trio, we company, we play some." I shook my head. "E.B., sir, you know anything at all about that psychology?" That was it, pretty much. Though he did say that Rombo's is just down the street. They'd be playing New Year's Eve tonight. "Why didn't I come? Get me free drinks," he said. "And hey, bring that horn, that cornet there, sit in. There'd be sure to be some drinks then." I said, "Thanks, I wasn't hurting for money. Could you bring that horn there? Give us more sound." I smiled. "See you later," I said, backing away. "You gonna sit in now?" I waved, glad to have some place to go later. I faded out the door like the ghost of a chance, like Jada, like a prisoner of love. I turned toward the hotel, but as I went by the entrance to my familiar alley onto which Green's office window opened, music stopped me. Music pulled me up the alley under the window. It was Georgia on My Mind. Nobody had to tell me it was being played on a flugelhorn. Nobody had to tell me what horn or who was playing it. Trombone mellow in the trumpet range by flugel. All was fair, and the lover she deserved had won it from me. Georgia, Georgia, the thought of you. There was no blare to it, no edge, yet the notes were round. Just an old sweet song, round on the ends and high in the middle. As I listened, I thought it was the soldier, after all, who held pale flowers, and that he'd search forever for the lost grave grown wild of the gauzy sun-glowed girl. Another chorus started ineffable. It was as if the notes were thoughts, and the players surrounding them with music, sliding and tumbling them to clarity and purification through that horn. I opened the cornet case, took the little beauty out, put in its small mouthpiece. I closed the case, set it onto the bridge of the alley, and sat down on it, leaning against the stucco wall under the high window. I opened the fake book to the index, found my number, turned to page 182, and there it was at the top, Georgia on. I put the little horn to my lips, and then, pressing now one vowel, now two, now three at random, I blew soundlessly a small puff for each note of his, pretending I could play.
Doc hasn't got a swift.